Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Patty James, Vice Chair of the Club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and Chair of this program. It's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Adam Ghazali. I'm getting there to the bio. It's on the second page. Oh, you're really going to clap if you're clapping just at his name. Here we go. Dr. Adam Ghazali was born and raised in New York City. He obtained an MD and a PhD in neuroscience at Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York. He completed clinical residency in neurology at the University of Pennsylvania, followed by postdoc training in cognitive neuroscience at UC Berkeley. Dr. Ghazali is the founding director of the Neuroscience Imaging Center at the University of California, San Francisco, an associate professor in neurology, physiology, and psychiatry, and principal investigator of a cognitive neuroscience laboratory. His laboratory studies the neural mechanisms of perception, attention, and memory in humans, and with an emphasis on the impact of distraction and multitasking on these abilities. A major focus of his research has been on the alterations in the aging brain that lead to cognitive decline. His most recent studies explore how we can use this knowledge to enhance our cognitive abilities through the use of video games. Dr. Ghazali has authored over 70 scientific articles, delivered over 200 invited presentations. Actually, today it's 250 today. Congratulations. And his research and perspectives have been consistently profiled in high-impact media, such as the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Time, Discover, PBS, NPR, CNN, and NBC Nightly News. There you go. Thank you.
Great. Excellent. Thank you all for coming out tonight to hear this talk. It's actually the first time I'm giving this talk. As you heard, I give a lot of them. I actually just got back from Bogota, where I gave a talk last week. But this one I'm really excited about. It's a topic that I've been thinking about for a long time. And it's always exciting when I'm exploring it to give a talk for the first time, because it just opens up how I look at it as well. So might be a little bumpy in parts, but we'll work through this topic. I want to just, I don't often do this, but I do want to give you the layout of how my talk is going to be today so you could follow along. Unfortunately, I might have to point at this since you can't see any red there, can you? Okay, part one I'm going to talk about. So basically the talk is going to be in two parts. The first part is a broader perspective of the literature. I'm not going to be speaking at all about my own research. It's going to define what I mean, or what I think the field means by cognitive enhancement. I'm going to talk about video games and then talk and tell you the evidence and also the controversy in video games being cognitive enhancers. The second part is going to be two studies from my lab. The first one that looks at the interface of perception, attention, and memory and how video games that were custom designed in our lab might alter that. And the second one is on distraction and multitasking. So that gives you a little roadmap for today. I want to start by defining cognition. You probably have heard the term many times. Maybe you have a clear idea of what it means. Maybe you don't. So it's helpful for me to define it because it means something very specific. And in this context of thinking about video games as enhancers of cognition, I want you to have at least a full idea of how I'm looking at cognition. So cognition is essentially neural processes that organize information. And that's important. It's a process. It's not content. It's not how much you know. It's how you know. Here's some examples of how we organize information. We select information, which is attention. We interpret information, which is perception. We retain and retrieve information, which is memory. We reason based on information, which is decision making. And we guide our behavior based on information, motor, speech, and language. So this is sort of a global view of what cognition is. So you'll know what I mean because I'm going to use that word a lot. Brain is what does cognition, right? There's a whole other talk on that. I'm not going to go into it. But the brain is the seat of our mind. It's the function of the brain to produce the mind. Cognition is one of the things that the brain produces, not the only thing, but certainly higher order abilities that are distinctly human in many ways are parts of cognition, although other animals have cognition as well. Cognitive enhancement. So you might have a view of what this is. I'm going to define it how I have been looking at it. It's the amplification or extension of core abilities of the mind via augmentation of information processing systems. Right? So it's the systems that are being augmented. So it's not necessarily learning more information. It's learning how to learn more information better or learning how to process information across those domains. I just want to point out a couple things. I'm going to distinguish in this talk between enhancement and therapeutics. In this way, enhancement is improving performance in a cognitive ability without correcting a pathology or dysfunction of the system, unlike a therapeutic where there's actually a deficit that then is being corrected. I'll talk a little about therapeutics as well, but for the most part, I'm talking about essentially healthy brains and how to improve them or augment them. Another thing is the scope of what we mean by cognitive enhancement. It's improving those core cognitive systems rather than narrowly defined skills or content-specific knowledge. So it's not just learning all the states in the country, right? That wouldn't fall into the realm of cognitive enhancement. It's actually increasing your ability to memorize things in general or to perceive the world better or to have better attention. So that's sort of the perspective there. This is complicated. Depending on what the baseline is, you could have a very different view of enhancement, right? So it could be, and I think some people might think this, making superhuman people, right? People that are beyond where their norm of their population is. I'm not really using it in that way. In this sense, I'm using it enhancing beyond an individual's baseline. So where you are bringing your cognitive processing systems to a higher level. But it could be thought about, you know, in many different ways. Okay, cognitive enhancement. There's lots of types of cognitive enhancement. Some that you're very familiar with. Education. Education at its finest should be enhancing our ability to process information, not just teaching us information, right? Meditation, very classic practice in the East that also teaches how you can focus and also relates to attention. Cognitive training, enriched environments. Lots of data on these things. These are not very controversial. You probably know about them already. Here's some other forms of cognitive enhancement. Does anyone here ever drink coffee? Okay. So coffee nicotine, very common. Whether or not they're really acting on the core processes of cognition or boosting cognition by creating higher states of arousal is still something that we question in a lot of ways. But in either case, I think they generally fall into this category, things you're familiar with. Here's some other things that you are probably familiar with that we now are getting an increasing perspective that they also improve cognition. Physical exercise, probably one of the best things you could do for your brain is to exercise your body. Most of the data is on aerobic exercise. I'm not going to go through that. Nutrition, dietary supplements, also evidence on that. Nootropics, that's how you pronounce it. Does anyone know what nootropics are? So these are medications that are designed to improve cognition. You might recognize this one, Aricept over here. This is the main medication that we use to treat Alzheimer's disease. It improves attention and thus improves memory in people that have this condition. Modafinil, has anyone heard of modafinil? Provigil, it's used to treat narcolepsy, and Ritalin and Adderall, I'm sure you've heard of these. Again, these are really drugs that are prescribed for treating ADHD and narcolepsy. But if you're not aware, these drugs are used extensively by college students. Extensively. Some studies say in one college in Boston, almost 60% of the people have used these drugs before. Other studies I see fall at around 25%. But still a massive amount of cognitive enhancement using pharmaceuticals on college campuses are going on. So this is a really, really important topic that we're going to have to address in some way or another. Neurofeedback. Does everyone know what neurofeedback is? You could essentially, we allow you to visualize or hear how your brain is working, and you learn how to shape neural processes by changing that visualization. Again, it has a nice tradition in ADHD. I still think there's a long way to go in that. Neuromodulation, transcranial magnetic stimulation, transcranial direct current stimulation, and brain-computer interfaces. So we're stepping further and further out into the tech world. So these are ways we use both these tools, TMS and TDCS, in our own lab. I'm going to tell you about them a little bit. These are ways that you could change how the brain processes information by applying a magnetic pulse or an electrical pulse to it through the scalp. Brain-computer interfaces usually involve implantation of electrodes. A classic one is deep brain stimulation that's used in Parkinson's disease, brain-computer interfaces. Genetic modification. I'm not going to talk about this much today, and it's certainly, as I think I went up on the controversy spectrum, but it's certainly something that is being entertained and being researched of improving the brain in that way. And then there are video games, and this is all that I'm going to focus on today, is how video games do this. But I did want to place this in the landscape of how we could think about improving our cognition and let you know that I think that education is in that category. And this creates an interesting discussion between enhancement and education. And is this just another way of thinking about education? So something to think about that we'll return to again. Video games. Who plays video games here? It's helpful to get to know the audience. Okay. Video games are possibly the most powerful form of media ever created. Why do you think that is? It's interactive. And it's fun, right? So you have interactivity and fun. That is a powerful, powerful combination. And you could see how powerful it is. They're essentially ubiquitous, right? So 90% of American children and teens play video games. Some actually put that number even higher. The typical youth plays for an average of 2 hours a day. That's the typical youth. There's certainly 4, 8, even higher. So you might have an idea about that already. Who has kids in this room that play video games? Okay, so you probably have a very good idea about that. Here's some facts, very recent ones that you might not know about video games. 70% of the heads of households play video games. 42% of gamers are women, right? This has changed drastically. You know, the whole domain of what video games are has changed with online play and internet and Facebook and things of that nature. The mean age of a gamer is 37 years old. Again, frequently not appreciated how old the average gamer is. So this is really now not a childhood phenomenon anymore, although it clearly is, but really something that affects everyone. And 29% of gamers are over 50 years old. So this is really a ubiquitous thing. They're also big business, really big business. So consumers spend $24.8 billion on video games, hardware, and accessories in 2011. That crushes every other entertainment industry, crushes it. This is, I thought, amazing. So Modern Warfare 3, has anyone played Modern Warfare 3? Call of Duty. Just came out in November. It sold 6.5 million units in the first 24 hours of release. $400 million, and that's just US and UK. That wasn't worldwide. It went on to gross $1 billion, this just happened, in the first 16 days of sale. People buying the game. So that's way beyond Avatar. Any movie that's ever come out has never reached that level. So just to let you know, this is serious business. This is not just a game, so to speak, right? You know, and our government, I was actually recently at a talk with Noah. Where are you sitting there, Noah? At the White House. And the White House is very interested in this topic of video games for attention and well-being. And Sophia was there as well. Anyone else there? And, you know, this is an important issue that the government is considering. We're telling them that video games can improve cognition, and they're asking, well, what is this, right? Because here we have something that clearly is grossing a tremendous amount of money and that everyone's doing anyway. So this is how the discussion is really advancing right now. Okay, but then you ask the question, do they have deeper impact? They don't have to. You can have an industry that grosses that much money that's that used, but, you know, it's entertainment. And there's nothing wrong with entertainment. Entertainment is a fine goal. But there's a question, do they have deeper impact? I found this really funny quote from Time Magazine, 1982. It says, this author said, video games are just another manifestation of human mania, our endearing quality of going relentlessly after absolutely pointless goals. Noah, have you heard this quote?
No.
Noah's a game designer. So I thought it was fascinating, you know, and I don't think that view is entirely unprecedented. I think a lot of people think that, you know, it's really for fun, but that's as deep as it goes. And I'm going to show you that view is grossly wrong, right? That is not what is going on with these games. Okay, before we talk about that, we have to realize that video games, asking are video games cognitive enhancers, I mean, it's fine for a title, but it's not a really practical question. And the reason why is because video games are vast. It's like saying, is food good for you, right? I mean, certain foods are better than others, and so let's talk about the types of video games. Lots, right? There's lots of types of video games. I am not going to be talking about any of them except this one, first-person shooters. That's where almost all of the data lives, on first-person shooters. And I'm going to take you through the data. I don't want to just give you a bunch of facts. I'm going to show you what this data looks like so you can appreciate it for yourself. Who has played first-person shooters in this room? Okay, lots of people. All right, I am going to show you what a first-person shooter looks like. So I found this online. I don't think I'm plugged in for sound. When you see it with sound, it's actually really a lot even more immersive. Medal of Honor, here we go. Take a peek at this. So you could see this soldier is moving through this battlefield. Very precise targeting is going on, as well as a broad view of what's happening in the field. If you heard this, it would be loud. The players using sound to help direct where they're moving. They have to know who's on their side, so they're using selective attention. There's lots of distractions. Here's a switch in the motor movement that's going on from shooting to throwing this grenade. They're moving out into the field. This part, I think, is interesting. You'll see over here This is not an enemy that runs out, right? Selection is going on way in the periphery of vision. Then they move in high resolution. Very precise responses are being made, and also very broad viewing of fields. So that's basically what I'm going to talk about for a while, those games. Now, we're going to come and we could talk about the violent aspect of them, whether or not it's bad, if it's good, does it have to be there to have these effects? I'll come back to that. But for now, I just want to talk about the cognitive aspects, because it's potential that you can pull away lessons from these, and that's really what my research has been doing, and then apply them in a way that maybe is not violent. Maybe violence is part of it. I'll come back to that. And so the question is, do these games, how do players of these games compare to people that do not play these games when you bring them into the laboratory and test them on cognitive tests? So I'm going to show you a whole lot of data, because I think that that's really helpful. And largely what we're going to comparing are players that play for around 4 to 6 hours per week versus non-players that either don't play at all or play less than an hour a week. They might play other games, but they don't play these games, first-person shooters. So attentional capacity. This is work that's really pioneered by this paper in Nature in 2003 called Action Video Games Modifies Visual Selective Attention by Sean Green and Daphne Bevelay, both of whom I work closely with now. And I'm going to go through the data from this paper so you can see what we're talking about, what exact type of cognitive processes are changing. So bear with me as I go through a lot of these tasks. Here's the flanker task. You probably can't see this, but there's a triangle in these circles, and then there's a triangle on the outside. That's called a congruent match. So you have to press the button if it's a triangle, press a different button if it's a square. And you might have, so this is a triangle with a square, this is a triangle with a triangle. You're faster on this one, right, on the compatible one, because they're consistent. They're not creating a mismatch. So what we can do is increase the difficulty, and this is what Daphne Bevelay and Sean Green did in this paper. They increased the difficulty by adding. You could see how much harder it would be to do this one than this one. You have to search a lot more, and likewise on the incompatible. And then they compared non-players versus video game players. So non-players are in green, video game players are in blue. And this is what a non-player looks like. As it gets more difficult, their actual compatibility effect decreases. That might seem strange. It seems like they're less distracted. And that's because they've used up their attentional resources. They're not even distracted by it anymore because they can't even see it. They have to focus so hard on what's going on. This is what video game players look like. You could see that they really don't change, even at the highest level. And this is a significant difference, suggesting that they have greater attentional capacity, the ability to be able to have resources come online, even in very challenging conditions compared to non-players. How about the distribution of attention? This is a very, very famous task called the useful field of view task. What you have to do is press the button for a target in which of these rows it's in, and it could be in a middle eccentricity, further out, or further out. It comes on very, very fast. So you focus in the middle, and you have to distribute your attention. And this is what it looks like in non-video game players. So it's actually a little easier to see further out than right in the middle, where it's a little more crowded. But this is what a non-video game player looks like. This is what these video game players look like. So a marked increase. I mean, this is 25, 30% localization. This is 80% at all eccentricities. Interestingly enough, if you look at the field of view that video game players experience these games, it's not at 30%. This is an improvement that carries over into their periphery outside of a level that they actually experience in their games. Okay, let's do another one. Speed of attention. This is a classic task called the attentional blink. This is how the attentional blink works. These letters come on really fast, like that, like literally like half a millisecond, like 50 milliseconds each. They come on, and you have to determine the white letter, right? So the white letter is L. But what you also have to do is say if there's an X that followed it, yes or no. And if this X is close to this L, you can't see it, because processing the L makes your attentional abilities pulled away, and it takes time to get them online again. So what this graph shows is this is the time, the distance in milliseconds, 100 milliseconds, 200 milliseconds, third of a second, fourth, right, in between the X and the L. You could see they're only getting 20% right. These are non-video game players over here when it's close, and then eventually they get them all right. Right? Once it's a second away from the L, they could see it. But so it's not that their eyes are blinking, it's that their attention is blinking, right? And this is not really ideal, right? You want your attention always being able to be deployed rapidly. This is what our players look like. Massive increase in their ability to rapidly regain their attention after being distracted. Now, these tasks are very, very different than the gameplay. I showed you the gameplay. These tasks are very boring. They're, you know, in very different domain. You might argue that they're still related to attention, and they are, and that's sort of the point. But you can see this really profound difference in these players. Actually, I'll tell you a story real quick how they came upon this research. I didn't plan on doing this, but they came upon this research because they were preparing experiments in the lab. Daphne Bevelez's lab and Sean Green was a student at the time. And they found that Sean just could not get 100% on these tests. And he's like, this is broken. And she says, well, let me play it. And she got like 60%. She goes, it's not broken. Let some other people play it. He let his friends play it 100%. It turns out they were all video game players. And then they found out that they just had this absolutely superior ability, and this is what led to this whole field. Really remarkable. We really screen for these people right now, which is, you know, a lot of people, because they add so much variance in the data if we have people that play and people that don't play. You see how different they are. Let's move on to another one. Items and attention. In this task called the multiple object tracking task, these dots are on the screen. Let's say three of them turn red, then they turn green again, and then the dots shuffle around. And then a dot lights up and says, was this one of the red ones? Got it? So you have to track these objects in mind. This is what performance looks like in a non-player. As you add circles, it gets harder and harder and harder. And then they just really have bottomed out and basically a chance. This is what video game players look like. Again, a significant difference, certainly in this middle realm. They're able to detect these circles, hold them in mind. I really think that this, a lot of people describe this as a type of attention. I really think there's a type of working memory, holding information in mind, because it's that period of time when they're all green and they're holding it in mind, spatial working memory, really superior. Sustained attention, I think this one's really interesting. This is called the TOVA. This test is frequently used in children with ADHD, both as an outcome measure on trials and sometimes in the diagnostic process. What's going on here? I'm just telling you one part of the TOVA. They're looking at very infrequent targets. So there's a black square at the bottom. It comes up. They watch it, comes up again. Then eventually one comes up on the top and they have to press the button. It is literally the most boring task you can imagine, which is really its point. It's how long could you keep focused on this boring thing and how rapidly can you respond when this rare target comes up. This is the difference in reaction time between non-video game players and video game players. Lower reaction time is faster. So they're much faster at responding to this. Well, you might think, well, they're trigger happy. They shoot things all day long in these games. So the way to tell is you look at an impulsivity measure, you see how accurate they are. So if they're more impulsive, they should be pressing it for these, which would be counted as a negative hit and drop their accuracy. And that's not what happens at all. They're not less accurate. On some tests, they actually even are more accurate. So they are able to sustain attention on very boring tests, even though they play on these very immersive games. Okay, task switching, another very important part of interacting with the world. On this, a shape comes up, a red shape, a colored shape. So one comes up at a time. So red square, blue circle, blue square, red circle, blue square. But what you have to do is when it's on this part, you have to say the color, red, blue. And then when it switches to this part, you have to not say the color, you have to say the shape. So square, circle, square. So how fast you are to doing a square when it follows a circle versus a square when it follows blue is called your task switching cost. How quickly were you able to, right? So this is going to be slower than this because you have to switch it around in your mind that I'm not responding to color, I'm responding to shape. This is the switch cost, the difference between these two. Non-players in green showing a large switch cost and video game players in blue showing a much, much more rapid, less switch costs. They're able to move rapidly between these tasks. This is a manual version of the task, and then there's a vocal version. Even when it's not visual, they're faster at it. Okay. But that's correlational data, right? That's data of a population versus another population. And the potential danger in that type of experiment is what's known as a cohort effect or an expert effect. It might be that video game players have better abilities in this domain. And that's why they play video games, because they're good at them. And people that aren't, don't have these skills, aren't good at them. So it doesn't, it's provocative, right? But does it really tell us whether or not video game playing actually improves these abilities? It really doesn't. It does not answer that question. With 10 hours of gameplay, I'm going to show you a whole bunch of data showing that Medal of Honor versus Tetris shows only this game. So what they did in this experiment, they took non-video game players, largely women, girls actually, college, and compared them in these two games. Let me show you some of the data. So Tetris versus Medal of Honor, the useful field of view, I already showed you. This is where you have to identify the target and the eccentricities. This is the green is Tetris. The solid is before, and the dashed is after. It did not have an effect on this ability. This is the Medal of Honor before. It looks a little higher, but it's not significantly higher. But this is after gameplay. After just 10 hours of gameplay, these women who had not had any experience with this had a much more profound useful field of view in all domains. Here's the attentional blink I already showed you. Here's the attentional blink for the non-video game players before and after, and in blue, the Medal of Honor players before. And here's what it looks like after. So not as extreme as a video game player that plays 4 to 6 hours a week, but certainly suggests that this is causal, that playing these games are improving these abilities. So improving both distribution, speed of attention, multiple object tracking. This is a different study using 30 hours of gameplay. Here's the non-action game, pre and post, really no change. And here's the big change in post in these people. Again, able to track more objects more accurately after 30 hours of gameplay. This one I think is interesting as well. This is a useful field of view experiment. And what they did was they didn't just look at the difference. So players in, I don't know if you can see this, players in gray, non-players in the open circles. So players are better at useful field of view than non-players. We already know that. And this is a training study. But in this version, this is the non-training version. So we just found video game players, non-video game players. But then they split them by gender. And interestingly enough, there's a gender effect, that males are a little better at this than females. And this has been known to some domains that spatial attention is sometimes found to be stronger in males. And so there's a gender effect over here. But what's interesting is that when you look at the after video gameplay, so 10 hours of video gameplay, what you find in the non-action games is no change at all. Here's the gender effect, males, females. But with action gameplay, the females improve more than the males. And basically what happens is that the gender differences disappear in spatial attention. So the gender differences were there before video gameplay, after the females in this experiment learned more rapidly on this skill. So again, sort of interesting findings. So I'm going to summarize now. And again, none of that research is my own, sort of just summarizing the field. These are the domains in which these gamers have superiority. Attentional capacity, distribution of attention, speed of attention, number of items in attention, sustained attention, task switching. These are the ones I did not tell you about, but papers exist in all these domains as well. Multitasking, working memory, both updating, the speed of visual search. In blue are other papers that replicated those findings, right? So you could see some of them have been replicated, you know, five times. Task switching, a lot of people do that. And then these are the papers in orange that have had training data, so not correlational, actual training data. So I think it's rather convincing that play on these games leads to a change in processes of attention and working memory, certainly. Including things like executive function, like multitasking, task switching, things of that domain. And I think that data is fairly clear. One other thing is that some studies have shown sustainability. You're not going to be able to see this from the back. But basically, in spatial attention, visual sensitivity, and mental rotation, these effects are preserved 5 months later after not playing the game again. That's why it falls into this domain of cognitive enhancement. The processes in the brain themselves are being changed by this type of interaction. Okay, let's talk about the neural basis of this, neuroplasticity. For a long time, we thought the brain, who here was at the neuroplasticity talk that I gave? Okay, I'll go through it. Okay, up until like the 60s, a lot of people tended to think that the brain was really static, that it was like a piece of concrete, that once you went through a developmental period, the brain was static and fixed, right? Some of you might have heard this idea. This is not at all how we feel. We don't feel it's immutable, unchangeable, that it's hardwired. We feel that the brain is a little closer to this. I wouldn't actually say jello for sure, but certainly that it's malleable. And I'd say a definition of plasticity is the brain's ability to modify its function and structure in response to new experiences. That is what's going on in this video game play. It's not that they're necessarily learning strategies. They're learning how to learn, as Daphne likes to say. And their brains are changing in response to it in a way that's enduring. So let's take a look at some of the data for this. This is an experiment done, first author Jyoti Mishra is actually in my lab right now. And it's a little complicated, but basically you're looking at these streams of letters that are going by at different frequencies. And you might have to detect something in one like, let's say, the left side, or on the right side, or in the center. So at any given time, something is relevant and something else is irrelevant that's still in your field. So it's sort of like a distraction experiment. The video game players, this is not a training study, so it does have potential cohort effects, but the video game players versus non-video game players, they were more accurate and they were faster on this test that I just showed you. But when you look at what happens in their brains, this is EEG data, and this is looking at when information is coming at a certain frequency, your brain actually activates at that frequency. So it's a little trick that scientists could do to see how much you're paying attention to different things when they're being presented at the same time. So they could look at the frequency, the 8 hertz frequency that was relevant, compare gamers to non-gamers, and there was no difference. So gamers and non-gamers were equally focusing on what was relevant. But you could look at the frequencies that corresponded to the streams that were irrelevant, and then there is a difference. So you could see the green, the yellow is higher. I don't have a scale on this, but yellow, red, the warmer colors are more activity in this domain. You could see that the non-gamers are paying more attention to these irrelevant streams than the gamers. So the basic idea from this study is that the video game players are developing a better ability to shut out distracting information and filter that information. Here's another experiment done with fMRI. Is it a square or a diamond in the ring? The answer is a diamond. There's motion over here, moving dots that are just meant to distract you. In another experiment, you can see here these are all circles, and this is a diamond. Here are these other shapes. This is a lot harder, right? It's a lot harder to find that is actually a square in this. So high load versus low load. When you do this in the scanner with video game players versus non-video game players, what we find is, or what Daphne has found, is that the high load versus low load shows more brain areas being brought online to do that more difficult task. The video game players don't show that. They don't need to bring these other resources online. It's easier for them. They don't have to bring these areas in the parietal cortex. The high load and the low load are very similar to them. And they recruit less cortical areas. And again, the distraction effect. So the moving dots in the middle, you could look at an area in the brain that is responsive to motion. And it shows that both in the high and low load, the non-gamers show more activity than gamers. So in a different experiment, gamers are filtering irrelevant information more effectively, breaking down that interference. Okay. This is obviously the dominant literature in the field, and I could tell you that for a fact. I spent a long time going through it. But there's certainly caveats, questions, and concerns. So to be fair, I want to tell you them. Some question, are they really cognitive enhancers, despite all that data? And they would say that there are methodological limitations, such that there are expert effects, as I already pointed out, that in the experiments where you compare video game players and non-video game players, there's that potential confound. Placebo effects, that knowing that you're coming to do a video game study might lead you to perform better if you're a video game player than non-video game player, and that some feel that the controls might be unbalanced, that Tetris is maybe not as much fun, and so there are fun differences. I just want to point out that that's how at least some people in the field feel, that there's something here, but they're not exactly sure what. And some studies have found more limited effects. There aren't that many of these, a couple, but some studies have found not as great effects, and there's lots of debate about why that is. And lastly, there's a very big, important question. If you're better at these skills, are you better in the real world? Are you better at driving? Are you better in the supermarket? Are you better in the classroom? That is a massive unknown, right? So these tests, I feel, are very convincing for the most part, showing that these abilities are improved. But it's very hard to know that real-world change in kids that are already very high-functioning. So anyway, it's something that the whole field acknowledges as something very important to clarify. Then there's the question of, are they dangerous, right? And that's at least worth pausing on. There's the addictive nature. There's no doubt that it seems, at least, and the definitions of addiction in this domain are very unclear. Some research has used the criteria used for gambling addiction as the sort of basis for it. And then it certainly seems that some people do become addicted to it and that it might impair other life activities because they're so absorbed. Impact on development, the violence issue. So the violence issue is a whole talk in itself. I could tell you that there are very strong differing opinions on this topic. Some people feel that it does increase aggression. The amount of data for actual violent behavior seems very low. But whether or not aggressiveness is a little increased, is that aggressiveness beyond what would happen if you watched a violent movie? Some people question that. It's not beyond any other violent form of media. The problem with this literature is that it's basically all correlational. So when it comes to legislation, so this was the case Schwarzenegger versus the Entertainment Merchants Association, which was just settled a couple months ago. Essentially, in the state of California, they were trying to restrict video game purchase to kids, violent video games, to kids under 18 years old. And basically, just can't buy it, right, like pornography. And that was what the case was, and it was settled. Does anyone know the decision just recently? So the state really was the Supreme Court of the United States made this decision, was very clear that this is an invasion of First Amendment rights, that you cannot restrict it. I'll read you this quote. It said, "Psychological studies purporting to show a connection between exposure to violent video games and harmful effects on children do not prove that such exposure causes minors to act aggressively. Any demonstrated effects are both small and indistinguishable from effects produced by other media. Since California has declined to restrict those other media, for example, Saturday morning cartoons, its video game regulation is wildly under-inclusive." So this has led to like a series of articles on both sides of it. I'll leave you to dive more into this, but I think it is an important issue that's not worth ignoring. Okay, then there's the potential for this. This is sort of a scary picture I've used in other domains. Maladaptive plasticity. Plasticity could go in different directions, right? It just means your brain changes. It doesn't mean your brain changes in a good way. And so are there changes that are occurring that are maladaptive that lead to other problems in life? Important questions. Okay, I'm going to switch over to the second half and tell you about my own experience in this domain. So this will be sort of the more, at least from my perspective, the more personal side of it, of how I got into this whole area of research. So this is how my research program, my laboratory is located at the UCSF Mission Bay campus. We just moved into a brand new neuroscience building that's quite beautiful on the Mission Bay campus, fully devoted to neuroscience. And this research I've been doing since 2002 when I was a postdoc at Berkeley. So this is around a 10-year research program now. And we ask questions in this domain. First, we ask, how does it work, it being cognition in many ways? So how does attention, memory, and perception interact with each other? We use functional MRI, EEG, transcranial magnetic stimulation. I'm not going to tell you about all this data. We ask, how does it change? How does it change as we get older? How does it change as we have Alzheimer's disease? So we use these measures to define the basic parameters of how the brain works and then ask, how does the brain change in some way, and how does behavior change? Now we're interested in, can we use this information to actually fix it, to enhance the brain, largely of older adults, and that's what I'm going to tell you. But it could be applied to younger adults. We're doing some things in that domain as well, or it could be applied to therapeutics, and I'll tell you a little bit about that. So I'm going to tell you about my research in can we fix it. So I'm going to tell you two studies. The first one was from 2007 to 2009, and this is where we were getting our feet wet as a lab on trying to look at how this emerging world of video games, you know, which had not been around so long, how it might be something that we could use to improve cognition in older adults. And for this, we focus on a particular type of training known as practice-based training, also called plasticity-based training or process-based training. And essentially what it is, oh, I took that part of the slide away. Let me go back for a second. Essentially what it is similar to what you do in the gym if you go to a physical fitness gym. It's repetitive, it's adaptive, you get feedback on how you're doing. It's opposed to the other type of training that's very common, which we call strategy-based training. So there's a strategy to help improve memory that's been around since the ancient Greeks called method of loci. Does anyone know about that? So it's basically you picture something that's very familiar to you. Sometimes people call it a memory palace. You walk through it and you place items that you're trying to remember in places that are very familiar to you. It takes advantage of the power of visual imagery, which is a very, very strong ability in most people to help remember things. So it's a strategy. It's powerful. You get really good at some particular thing, but it doesn't have very much transfer often. You get good at that particular thing. Well, practice-based training that really capitalizes on plasticity is felt to actually be more of an enhancer of cognition and changing how the processes work. So we ask this question, will training perception and attention lead to an improvement in memory, your ability to remember over time? And so for this first study, we did a very basic task, and this was in collaboration with Posit Science, a local group that builds brain training software. And essentially, you see these two lines that either spread in or spread out, but you see one, and then you see the other, and they're very quick. So I'm going to show you what this looks like now. The first one's going to be 200 milliseconds. It might be out, in, and then in, in. You have to try to see that, see what it is. It's going to be really hard from where you're seated. The second one is at 100 milliseconds, and then it goes even faster and faster. So as you get better, it challenges you by going faster and moving closer together. I just want you to see what a 200 millisecond looks like. So here we go. Did anyone see what that was? In out. Last one was in out. Let's show you again. It's hard. Older adults get really good at this. Everyone gets good at this. With practice over time, your brain learns how to identify this information. This was embedded in a video game where there's rewards for getting it right because it's pretty boring, as you can see. And so in order to let people train on this over time, it was embedded in a video game that has different colors, different angles, so it trains different parts of the visual cortex. But it's not a memory task, right, in any way. And our question was, will this actually lead to better memory abilities? And so what we did was we pre-tested in our lab on, I'm going to tell you what those tests were, and then we trained at home, and then we post-tested again. And so when we just look at the train task, the group, the older group, so this is 60 to 80-year-olds, healthy adults, they got way better on this test compared to the group that did nothing. They basically came in, did the test twice on that task, right? So they got better at the task we were training them on. What's interesting is we did EEG on this task. And I just want to point out one thing. It's actually unpublished data, but I feel like it makes an important point. This is called an ERP. It is the signal that is time-locked to right at the beginning when this comes on. This is the period when you're transitioning between these two. You could see here that the group that trained in blue had a different signal than the group that didn't train. I'm not going to go into what that means. It's how you process information visually. But what's really interesting is that by using the measure on day one, we get a pretty nice prediction of how someone's performance improves from day one to a month later. And that's something that I'm very interested in. Can we use these games with neural recordings to basically have a neural profile about how your brain works? And based on data, we could tell you what set of training, what set of games works best for you, customized intervention for your brain. And that's something that I think is exciting to move to. Here's a perceptual discrimination task, totally different task. These moving dots move in different directions. You have to say, do they match each other? What we found is, here's the older control group in yellow. It's basically flat. So this group, here's day one, here's session two, a month later. They didn't change at all. Here's the older adults. They improved. The lower level means that you can distinguish between angles that are closer together. Here's their memory, their ability to remember this direction and match it to that direction. Again, we have a really nice improvement in this group that trained on this task, which was very different, had no memory components. If we put in the levels of younger adults on a single visit, it's this green line. So you could see after, just a month of practice on this task, we were able to change the performance to the level of younger adults on this task, and we published this paper last year. If we look what's happening in the brain, we could see that the group that does training, this is the pre-post difference, red shows that they're actually processing the visual information less, while the control group shows no difference. Blue and green is really at zero. So this is something that we've now come to realize from a lot of studies that have looked at the impact of training the brain on how you process information. A lot of people intuitively thought that as you got better, you would have more activity. What we almost always find is that you have less activity. You learn how to process information more efficiently. And so we often see that there's less activity after training. An exciting part of this is that there's a very strong correlation between the change in this brain activity and the change in performance. And I won't go into this in detail, but this is something that we're excited about, is using neural markers to be able to plot how an interaction, like a video game interaction, is actually changing your brain, in this case, in a very predictive way. Okay, second study. So this was a big study from 2009-2012. We're just about ready to publish it. So unlike the last study, this study is unpublished. This is the first time I'm presenting it, so I'll take you through some of the data on this, and we're pretty excited about it. Some of it is very new. Okay, this is really inspired by an intersection of the research in our lab, video games for impact, I'm going to describe what that is, and then what I already told you, action video games as cognitive enhancers. Video games for impact. So this is not occurring in isolation, the fact that we think that video games might improve cognitive abilities. I'm thinking of them as cognitive enhancers. Video games have been thought to be able to be a tool to impact many different domains. Sometimes this is called the serious games industry. I actually recently heard this term and liked it a little better, so I'm using that now. But advertising, health, productivity, education, persuasion, like political type of parties and domains. So there's a lot of interest right now in the power of video games to impact behavior. I'm just going to point out a couple from the health and education domain. So here are some games, some well-known games. Remission, a game that teaches through gameplay children to have better adherence to cancer medication, to chemotherapy. We Fit, you're probably all familiar with, is some data emerging, as well as Dance Dance Revolution, which was never meant to be a game to improve exercise that really has benefit. But really what I'm talking about here are games that are designed, same thing in the education domain, a knowledge enhancer, and things that change attitudes and motivation. And so we see a lot of this going on. It's a very big and growing field. But right in the sweet spot of health and education is cognition. And that's what's become like sort of a recent realization for me, is that cognition really serves as this sort of bridge between education and health, especially when we're thinking about in this domain. There's actually only a recent realization of mine, so it's really at that sweet spot. Then there's action video games. And I already told you about the effects, but the question is, what makes them so effective? These are some views of my own, as well as Daphne Bevilea and her colleagues. They're fast-paced. They're unpredictable. So you saw that game. Just keep that in mind. They're engaging. They have adaptable difficulty. As you get better, they get more challenging. Not on a real-time basis as we do in lab, but they still keep challenging you. You get feedback. You have errors. You have motivating rewards that inspire you. They're rich and immersive worlds that people engage in. And this is one that I added. They challenge working memory, attention, processing speed, and interference. These are the limitations of our brains, right? This is probably the four of the biggest areas that we have very defined capacity limitations. These games challenge all of those things. And then there's the research from my lab. So this, again, 2002 to 12, and in the danger of trivializing all of the work that my lab has done, I'm going to summarize it in two sentences. So the first is that we know that distraction and multitasking negatively impact memory, and we've studied the neural mechanisms on those, and these are our publications over the years. And the other is that this impact of interference gets worse as we get older. So that basically summarizes what we've spent the last 10 years documenting and defining how it works, obviously with a little bit more details. So what I wanted to do was to see if we could take this concept that we have problems with interference, that it gets worse as we get older, couple it with the ability that with this emerging theme that we can build games, video games, to target this, and also thinking about what are the elements of an action video game. You notice I did not put violence on that list. It's an open-ended question. We do not know the contribution of violence to those effects. You know, violence is pretty motivating, especially in young boys. So I don't know. It's an open-ended question, one that we're very interested in. Can you dissect that out and still get these impacts? That's something that we're very interested in. So in this study, we asked, can we develop an action-like video game, right? So this was the beginning of this, which is advanced now, to enhance the ability for older adults to resolve interference, essentially to multitask, which we've documented very well declines with age. So for that, I worked with colleagues of mine in the video game industry. One of them is right here, Noah Falstein, who's a video game designer, and also other friends of mine that were working at LucasArts at the time that are video game programmers as well as artists. And essentially, we had these amazing meetings where they would come down to the lab and we'd meet with my students and postdocs and say, here's what is just broken in these older adults and their brains. It's frustrating to them. They have problems in distracting environments. They have trouble switching tasks. It's well documented. A lot of them can experience the burden of it. We want to create a game that has elements of action video games, as we've talked about, and couple in some of the fundamentals that we use in the lab. So we use real-time adaptivity using an approach of psychophysics called the staircase algorithm. So as you play, the game challenges you always at a level that puts you right at the limit, right? So it's not too easy, where it would be boring. It's not too hard, where it would be frustrating. We use this type of approach to challenge all our participants and keep them right on the edge of where it's enjoyable and pushing the brain's plasticity. That's sort of the general idea. In this very early version of the game, you're driving this car on a road, and so you're trying to not fall off the road. The road is moving all over the place. And then you're responding to only certain signs, sort of like shooting an enemy. Only the green circles, but not the green squares, or the green pentagons, which are very hard not to press for, and the red circles. And so you play this game, and the general experiment is you come into the lab for three visits. This was a really tough experiment for our participants. They came in for three visits beforehand. They took home a laptop. We had a collaboration with Apple. They gave us 40 laptops that we distributed to older adults around the Bay Area. They played this game for 12 hours, one-hour sessions three times a week, so 4 weeks of gameplay. While they played, the camera on the game came on right when they started playing. They knew this, and it was to keep them in the context that this is an experiment. They shouldn't be like drinking a beer, playing with their cat. You know, really, this is an experiment. And the data from the game went right to a Dropbox account and right to the lab server. So we could essentially see them playing the game at home in our lab, essentially in real time. So really good for following adherence to this program. And then they come back into the lab and we see what changes in their brain, what changes in their cognition. And I'm going to show you this data for the first time now. We're just about ready to submit it. We're super excited. This experiment took 3 years. It had a very large grant through the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which is the only organization that really stepped up during this period of time and was giving money for these type of ideas. I had a very difficult time at the NIH back then. I actually do now have NIH funding to do video game as cognitive enhancement research, but back then, so I really owe a lot to the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And there were probably over 40 people in my lab with volunteers that were collecting this data. So it's really a massive endeavor that I'm going to share with you. But if that wasn't enough, we did another experiment. We used the game, but we called it in diagnostic mode. So people either did the sign task, so green circle, respond as rapidly as you can, green square, don't, red circle, don't. You play this game. And you could do that, so this is pretty boring, right? You do that alone, or you do that while you're also driving. And then we have an index of how much worse you do when you multitask, right? And the multitasking cost is this minus this over this. So the percentage that you drop when you do two things at once versus one thing. And then we did something pretty unique, certainly unique for our lab, is that we weren't asking just the question of what's the difference between 20-year-olds and 60-year-olds. We said, what does it look like right across the whole lifespan? This data is a little more rare, especially for neuroscience experiments. And so here's 20-year-olds, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70-year-olds. So 80 was our upper cutoff, 20 was the lower cutoff. Zero means no cost. It means you do the sign task just as well when you do it alone, as well as when you do it driving as well. This is what 20-year-olds show, 27% drop, right? So they really are impacted significantly by doing the sign task and also driving at the same time. I was going to ask, has anyone in this room participated in this study? There's a lot of people. There's over 250 people that went through this experiment to fill out this time course. Here's what older adults look like. 70-year-olds, 63% drop. Massive, massive drop in performance by doing the second task. I also want to point out that the test was thresholded first. So everyone played the game at their own ability level. So before you played the game, it determined using this algorithm approach, this staircase algorithm, at what level you played and performed 70%. So a 70-year-old, so if you were a 20-year-old looking at a 70-year-old playing, you'd be like, that's no fair. That game's way easier. It's so much slower. Look how slow they come up. The driving's slower. But the reality is this game was equally difficult for both age groups, right? So that's how we control for difficulty effects. So this 63% drop is in the context that the game was equally difficult for them when they did the tasks apart, and then we ask what happens when you put them together. Does that make sense? So that's an important control that's very frequently missing. So what happens from here to here? Do you just go along your whole life, and then all of a sudden you hit 70 years old and these abilities start declining? No, this is what happens. So we have a linear change in this ability throughout life. Actually, the steepest difference between two age groups was between 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds. And this multitasking ability is very linear, very, very linear. You could see just changes and gets more. This is the depressing part of the talk. It's going to get better in a second, so just bear with me. Okay, let's make it better. We did this. So this study was one part of the study. So this is all going to be in one paper. So we have the pattern across the lifespan of how multitasking changes. Really hasn't been plotted out before. And then we say, let's bring back the 60 and 70-year-olds and see if we could train them playing the game. And so we had another group of older adults, and you could see that it replicates the findings. So a different group of older adults showed the same effect. And 1 month later, we brought them back. One group was the no-contact control. They basically went home. We brought them back a month later. And what we found was that the multitasking cost was exactly the same, which is actually very important, meaning that it's very reliable. It doesn't have very big practice effects. You bring them back a month later, they do exactly the same if they don't do anything. Then we had what I think is probably the toughest and one of the best controls we've ever used, is we had a group of older adults play the game for 12 hours at home, but they played it only in single task mode. They did the driving, they did the sign test, but never at the same time. So they had the same amount of time as the gameplay of the multitask group that played the game driving and doing the science. So that's a really nice control, because it could be that, you know, maybe just playing a computer, anything on the computer for a month is going to improve this ability. So that's a control for it. And so the single task training group showed some modest improvement, but not significantly above the no contact control group. this difference was not significant. And this is what the multitasking trained group looks like. So they had a 13% drop. They improved better than both of the control groups, and they were better than the younger adults in terms of multitasking class. Really shocking and very cool, I think. Then we did an experiment where we said, 6 months later, we want you to come back to the lab. They haven't played the game. We took the laptops back. Some were happy. Some were sad about that. We could talk about that. But what we found in 6 months later is that this group did not drop significantly. 6 months later, they actually are now no different than the younger adults, the no greater. So there is a little bit of a change. And this group is right back at baseline. What this shows you is that in order to get better at this multitasking, you have to train in that environment, right? Which is an important point that we didn't really appreciate. And that's, you know, this is not full-out first-person shooter, but it has elements of it and sort of became the beginning of that, where there's lots of need for attention and working memory, remember your shape, there's distractors, uses full field, things of that nature. This is the training group's ability, pre-post difference on the TOVA test. Remember the TOVA test I told you is a test that's used it's a really boring test. So this group that trained in multitasking improved significantly beyond their pre-visit, and the group that did the single test training and the no contact control didn't change. So we have transferred, just like the action video games in the same domain, from this game that we created in the lab over, with no violence, over to the ability to sustain attention in a super boring task. So that's pretty exciting, I think, for transfer. Now let me show you what's going on in the brain. So all of these older adults did this experiment before and after while we recorded brain activity with EEG. And we also did it on younger adults. So we brought another group of younger adults back. I'm going to show you, this data is 2 weeks old. I really just saw this data. I'm super excited about it, so it's fun to share it right now. What we're focusing on here is something called frontal theta, midline frontal theta. And your brain has rhythms. That is how it functions. Theta rhythms are slow rhythms located in the front of the brain, helps you with concentration and attention. It's involved in working memory, executive function. We really focused in on that. Brought back a group of younger adults, and they showed lots of midline frontal theta. This is while they're doing the sign task and also driving. The older adults showed less midline frontal theta. This has been shown before. Older adults have decreased midline frontal theta that's often related to their problems with attention and multitasking. This is the no-contact control group, pretty much the same. So as it goes from green to yellow to red, it gets more and more activity, so it's a warmth scale. This is the single-task training group. They're actually still not at this level. And then here is the multitasking training group. So really, really shocking. So everyone sees that nice red circle in the middle? So this is significantly higher midline frontal theta than younger adults. So their brains are just really different, right, when they're doing this task. They're not just better at it, but their brains are showing more of this, which is just, you know, pretty exciting, I think, to see that type of change after only, you know, 12 hours of training. I mean, look at how long education usually involves. So anyway, right now what we're doing is we're working with a company. So as in terms of disclosure, I'm the chief science advisor of this company, and one of the co-founders, and what it's doing is bringing the same exact experiment that I told you into more and more of an action video game. So now this is a mobile game. This is the diagnostic period where you're looking at tracking. Here's the gameplay itself. This is still very old. My game team would be very upset if they knew I was showing you this right now. But many different worlds. It has characters. It has music and story and artwork. And all of the immersiveness of a 3D environment that makes games so appealing and so enjoyable. So the goal is to now make something that's even more fun that people will want to play. We're doing an experiment right now, my graduate student Omar in the lab, where we're interested in 40 to 50-year-olds, right? This is like the most understudied age group in the world. Is anyone in that age, 40 to 50? Why don't you come down to my experiments? It's very hard to study this age group. Younger and older adults are much more willing to come down to the lab to study, to do studies. And so this is a rather understudied group. But we know from that lifespan curve that 40-year-olds are significantly worse on this test than 20-year-olds. So why is that? Is this actually something different about their brains? Are our brains really degenerating from 23 on? Can we see the difference at 40? So we're doing essentially what I think is the first fMRI experiment comparing 20, 30, and 40-year-olds playing that game inside the scanner. So the beautiful thing is that when you build a game from scratch in your lab, you have full control over every aspect of it. So you can put it right in the scanner and see what's going on in their brains while they're playing that game. right, which has not really been done, not at this level. And then they take this iPad home, they play for a month, and there's a whole calendar. They have different diagnostic periods. There's four different challenge levels. Then they come back in the lab, and they go into the scanner, and we see what changed in their brain. So this has been done. The first people just started coming back yet. So I don't have this data, but it's what's happening now. And what are we doing next? So now, with some support of folks in the game industry, I became interested in how can we move our science out of the lab more effectively, right? So the type of experiments we do are not really accessible for most people, right? They're done on systems that are A, not fun, and B, not really amenable to the home environment. So what we did here was I came up with an experiment to train attention abilities. And first, just to document attention abilities. How well can you focus your attention versus distribute it, depending on what you know is going to occur next? It's called the predictive ability of our brain. But the challenge was to come up with a game that can be played on both a PC, an iPad, and Kinect. Does everyone know Kinect here? So Kinect is a motion capture game by Microsoft, a console. It's a system that basically senses your body in space. And as you move, unfortunately, we don't have the best video here, but as you move, your body moves in this space. And so it's really the same game. I don't know if anyone has done this yet. We're pretty excited about it. Here's some really early data showing that under predictive conditions, you're faster. When you have no idea where it's going to be, you're slower. And then when you know which side it's going to be on, you're somewhere in the middle. This is not entirely unknown, but here we show the exact same effect across three different platforms. And so we're collecting data, like real data from this iPad and the Kinect platform. Again, it has massive potential to translate broadly and widely since these game consoles and platforms, especially mobile, are becoming more and more common. I'm going to close now. I want to tell you really where we're pushing this. This is an approach, transcranial direct current stimulation. You might not know about this, but if you tried to learn how to play a sequence on a piano and you did it just normally, and you did it by applying the voltage essentially of a 9-volt battery, you would learn it faster, right? Pretty shocking. So just a very low level of voltage could increase plasticity in certain brain areas. 5 years ago, there were hardly any papers on this. If you look now, it's probably 20 every month now. I mean, it's really steep. It's exploding. People are using it for all sorts of ideas and trying to see what's happening. And so we're doing an experiment now. We're planning on it. We're setting up where you play the Kinect full body game while we're stimulating your brain with direct current stimulation to see if we could change your learning curve in a full body experience. Can we change that attention curve? Can we teach you to distribute your attention as effectively as you can focus your attention? And so there'll be a group that plays it with no stimulation, a group that plays it with stimulating the front part, the parietal part, and the visual part of the brain, and see if we could really change the rate of learning by stimulating the brain. This is going to go in other domains. This room, I call the Neuroscape Lab. It's right in the heart of UCSF's new neuroscience building. It's going to be a fully immersive world visually, environment both visually and auditorily, where you can step into these games and these experiments and interact in a much more natural way than we ever do in the experiments we do now. We can also build this game so that you're actually physically exercising in addition to cognitively exercising. That's one of our goals. We could have you wear not just a TDCS, but also an EEG cap. In that last picture, there's wireless EEG caps now, which you could bring to your home, put the cap on. The game will respond not just to how you perform, but what's going on in your brain. So it will be adapting itself, looking to see, is your midline frontal theta increasing enough? If not, I need to change some parameters. Could this be coupled with medications, like modafinil, also to improve brain concentration and focus? We have an experiment in the lab that's not based on a game like this, but based on meditation. We call it the East versus West experiment. It actually brings in ideas from concentrated meditation and video game technology. We have someone that helped on this game, Eileen, in our lab this summer. And it's exciting, again, to see, can we reach out and improve these abilities by using game techniques that have feedback and adaptivity, but might have very classic, you know, roots, such as in meditation. And then lastly is the question, how does all of this fit with what we think of as traditional education, which is being threatened in many ways by this emerging technology? We have to recognize that. There are Harvard has a full online university that some people would rather attend than go to classes. I'm not passing a judgment on it, but we have to be aware that this is how the system is changing. And so when you think of education as broader and you think of it including things like this, how does this work? How does this come together? With greater power comes greater responsibility. I think Spider-Man's dad said that. Ethics. I'm just going to put up some of the words that you will read when you read about cognitive enhancement. Safety, minors, authenticity, playing God, cheating, inequality, cosmetic neurology. That's my favorite. I'm a cosmetic neurologist now. So I am not going to talk about this. We're out of time, but it's still interesting. And obviously, it's worth pausing and think that when we could really change the brain powerfully, we have to do so in a responsible way. And then the last thing I want to say is that all of this has potential in many disease states. I'm just going to put up some here. These are some diseases that I've already have contacts. Sophia's in this room. She does a lot of work on schizophrenia and video games to improve these same abilities. And we actually have a study already started in ADHD and depression. So these games might even have more impact in changing these abilities and improving them in people that are suffering pathologies that decrease their ability to function. And I want to thank you for your attention.
Quick. Is this on? Yes. Thank you, Dr. Ghazali, for your comments here today. We also thank our audiences here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 109th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. That's official. So well, they're going to ask us to leave at 7:30, but I think we have time to, and that's slow. But do you have time to take some questions?
Yeah, sure.
So, Bill, you want to
I have a question in terms of the multitasking experiment that you are doing. In some ways, the more you know about the context in terms of repetitive practicing, the better you get, right? In terms of outliers, people say that the more you practice, the better you get. Have you done things that you compare two multitasking tasks in general or two different environments? When they're getting better in terms of one multitasking experiment, they're also getting better in terms of another multitasking experiment.
Yeah, that's a good question. That falls into the general domain of what we could call transfer. How do these abilities move to different domains? How does training and multitasking in the visual domain help you multitask in the auditory domain? Things like that. We're doing those experiments now. I mean, they're great questions. The ultimate goal here is that these things transfer into the real world, right? It's great to be able to come into the lab and kick butt on a test that we give you. But what you really want to do is to remember things better when you go shopping. You want to perform better at work so that you might not have to retire if you don't want to, so that you're safer on the road when there's so much irrelevant information. How to determine that is really very challenging. So that's the transfer that ultimately we want to achieve. The problem is that there's not always very careful quantitative markers of those type of performance measures. And also, you need large numbers of people. And so we hope that as we start moving this technology more mobily, so we're going to be doing an experiment where we hope to gather 100,000 data points of people playing this game, right, once the game is out there, and then building into the game questionnaires and other types of markers so that we could look for that type of transfer that's normally really hard to find.
Hi. I'm 65 and retired. How do I sign up to be a test subject?
Oh, that's easy. We're always looking for test subjects. So if you go to my website, there's a long name, and then there's G-A-Z-Z-L-A-B, gazlab.com, and send us an email, and we are always looking for participants. So we have lots of experiments going on right now.
This may be too early, but that last slide you said of some of your most recent stuff with testing the three different platforms. Glancing at that slide, it looked like people using the PC, presumably just moving a mouse, were taking much longer than people are moving their whole body, which really shocked me.
No, and good call. You have to be sitting up front to see that. All right, I'll tell you what that's all about. It's actually super cool. If I had more time, I would have told you about it. But when you do an experiment classically in the lab, you have a button response. And so you wait for your probe, and then you respond. Response. You always respond in the same place. When we started building this Kinect game where you have to respond, there was a problem, right? Because if it comes up here, you're going to get to it faster than if it's right over here. And this is actually sort of a weird thing to do. I mean, it's good, right? You're working out, but you're definitely going to be slower. So we're like, all our data is going to be messed up by the distance. And then we realized something amazing about the Kinect is what the Kinect is really good at is telling when you first start moving. So for the Kinect, what we're looking at is not when you get there, it's when you first initiate the movement. And so everything is faster, and the data is way better than anything we've ever gotten in a lab before. So that was like a total little twist that we didn't expect.
Hi. I had a question around, you know, equipment-based training in the military. I run a company called Heartwood 3D, and we produce 3D interactive applications teaching people how to use equipment.
Cool.
And, you know, the Army's using our application. The retention's gone up 70%. Are you doing any of that research in your research in terms
with
of...
with military?
Just not even just military, but with equipment, like learning how to use a construction equipment, you know, Caterpillar equipment, things like that before you touch it in real life.
Yeah, we haven't, you know, we're a cognitive neuroscience lab,
yeah.
And that's what we do. You know, we're already now pretty broad in that. We still study the basic mechanisms of how the brain changes, and now we're building these tools. It's not even just in the video game domain. We're also working on neurofeedback and other things as well. But we haven't left the world of cognition.
Johan Huber Gutierrez. I focus more on the marketing and e-commerce world, so I'm always looking at what gets people to buy or what gets people to do an action of any sort. And one thing I always kind of reference back to when I look at these things is when we look at the decline of play in education, as we go deeper into the education system as we get older and then we find ourselves in the professional world, there's a decline in play. And if you look at the natural world, and historically as we've studied animals, how they learn, it's always been through play. And would it be safe to say maybe that the introduction of video games is just reinstating play back into our lives, whereas, you know, we've kind of developed society in a way that we've taken play out because we're sitting at desks, we're not interacting in the way we used to, we're not out and about. I mean, is there a correlation there?
I would say that almost everyone in this field feels that fun is a critical aspect of why this works. You know, it's so funny. I wrote my first NIH grant with like video game in the title, and I was like, oh, this is not going to be good, and it wasn't good. I mean, that now it's better. But then using words like fun in a NIH grant and things like that, you know, enjoyable. I was like, are we like allowed to talk about that stuff? It feels so, you know, trivial, and I don't think it is. And now I feel much braver about it. I think that fun is a really, really strong part of driving engagement and plasticity. And I think that eventually we'll figure out a way to document that better. It's actually sort of challenging to have motivation without... it's an interesting challenge that I'm thinking a lot about. But I do think it's part of it. And remember, this is one part of games for impact is a bigger field. And so building games to teach people how to use construction equipment, games for marketing purposes, this is all part of the same sort of genre. And I think fun is critical.
You talked about the staircase algorithm.
Yeah.
What is optimal for people? Do they like to be 60% correct,
80%
correct?
Noah likes this point. Noah is, a very famous video game designer. And interesting, some of the things that we use in our lab are just not used in the video game world. We find that people like 70% as a generalization, but not everyone does. No one likes 100% and no one likes 50%, that's for sure. 70% is probably where people feel having fun. But that being said, we've talked about doing a pretest where you just find out subjectively where you like to be, you know, where you want to be challenged. And it might be different across populations. I don't think anyone's ever looked at things like this.
And Merchnick at the meeting said it was 75 or 80, he said.
Yeah.
He had a different number.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it's... Yeah, I think they're probably... Interestingly enough, I think that the level that you like and the level that drives plasticity are probably really close to each other. It matters on what the task is, too. Some tasks, 70% is more painful, and you need 80% because, you know, it just depends what you're doing. It really does. It's a great question. We're interested in that.
Have you been addressing in your lab comparing the cognitive enhancement from video games versus, for example, education, physical exercise, the other cognitive enhancers you mentioned?
No, we have not done that. So we have never done experiments, as you noticed, looking at video games in general. We've only looked at things that we built ourselves. I don't know anyone that's like compared to... It's really tough experiments, right, because they're very hard to control. You see people complain about the controls in Tetris versus Medal of Honor, right? You know, try to compare Medal of Honor to, you know, sitting in a classroom and get that published. So, you know, it's a challenge, but... it's very important. I have like a very strong stance on the fact that we will never figure out how to improve our brains by focusing on one thing. It won't work. Education alone will not allow us to reach our potential. And it's the same thing for disease states. Drugs will never work alone. Our brain is too complicated. You can't just put a chemical on the brain and expect to improve depression without engaging the brain in a way that's appropriate, that's going to help that medicine work better. So I feel really strongly that all of these tools are going to come together in a way to have a bigger impact than they ever have. I think it's a fault of, like, our pharmaceutical system is that they did grow in these silos. You know, one drug, you know, what do they compare it to, a placebo or the standard of care? Not like, how does this drug different when you're doing physical exercise? You know, how's this, you have Alzheimer's disease, you're taking this drug, it's increasing your cholinergic system, but you're sitting at home watching TV. Well, how about if you're using your brain, what would happen? No one's done those studies. So I think that, you know, more important than comparing them is seeing how they interact.
Just wondering, is there any good research on what is fun, on what drives engagement?
We've heard work about motivation at the White House, right?
There's a whole field of around motivation. It's a psychological field as opposed to a cognitive neuroscience field at this point. There's a tiny bit of work with some animal models.
The problem is that motivation does not equal fun, right?
Exactly.
And so it's a great, I spent a lot of time talking to people at that meeting about that very aspect. You know, what happens when you take the fun out? Does this disappear? How do you take the fun out and keep the motivation in, right? Else that would be a massive confound, right? So it's complicated, but I think there's a way to do it. I don't think anyone's done it that I know of. What?
Give people money.
Yeah, that's true. They're like our normal experiments. We know they're less effective.
Another question about transfer. So it seems like transfer is really the crucial question in general with cognitive enhancement. In terms of the two areas that you said were basically most replicated and also had testing that was being done with them, so the task switching and the distribution of attention, and perhaps other assessments as well, has there been a recent look at how well high performance on those assessments seems to correlate with performance in a lot of sort of real-world areas?
No, I'm not aware of that data.
Because it seems like that would potentially help a lot for running these studies more quickly.
The problem with it is that when you have healthy young people doing this, it's really hard to see, are they doing better? You know, I mean, it could be, you need really, really large numbers to see those type of real-world effects because, you know, this quantitative data is so tight. Like, these experiments are so perfectly designed to pull out these differences. The real world is just a messier place. Like, how do you determine this? And I think that's part of why there hasn't been that.
Are these associated with IQ at all?
There is some training, and some of this has shown IQ relations.
Is IQ associated with real world success?
It's a very debated field. People have strong different opinions on it. That's true. That's true. I was going to mention that. I'm a little out of it. I flew in last night. So I was going to say the useful field of view test, which I showed a lot about, the distributed attention, that probably has the best evidence for transfer. People that do well on that, if you're an older adult and you do well on that, you probably have a lower incidence of car accidents. And so there is actually some really impressive data that shows that that ability transfers to driving abilities, actually better than visual acuity and better than overall IQ, the mental acuity. That test is better. And it makes sense, right? I mean, it's your ability to get your attention out here when you're looking out over there, which is critical for driving. So that is one example. And that, yeah.
So I'm working on a project called Quantified Mind with Yoni Dana down at Stanford. And one of the things that we have a lot of trouble with is sort of designing. It's about testing and people doing it at home. So, A, sort of controlling the sort of experiments that we run and the data that comes out of it. And B, again, the question of sort of engaging people to take part in it long run. So on both of those, what's worked best in your experience?
Well, that's a good question and a tough one. I think that this is why we have so actively engaged people in the video game industry, because they're experts at making things fun and immersive and even addicting. And so I didn't claim that I had this magical ability to do that. I know what I do well, and I know when I need help. And I think that made our lab and our experiments really unique, is that at a very early stage, I mean, it's a blessing of living here in the Bay Area, where, you know, there's so many people in these different tech fields and the video game industry. And so I think that the way to accomplish it is to work very closely in parallel as either scientists or technologists in other fields. If you're building for education, if you're building for the workplace, marketing with video game designers, and don't think like, oh, it's a game and I can make a game and I'm going to put some points and some lights on it and some colors and then it's a game. I don't feel like that is really what a game is at its core. Game mechanics are very complex. There are experts at it, and it's worth working closely with them.
Hello. Almost all of your demonstrations have been around visual things. I'm just wondering if you've developed any auditory models like this around pitch recognition,
yeah,
or melody recognition, or with musical counterpoint or anything.
Yeah, we have that. We have actually two papers that we're writing on auditory right now. Posit Science has done a lot of work on auditory, at least training. You know, whether, you know, this training exercises and are they video games, this is also another complex domain that I'm not going to step in right now. But there is a lot of work through Posit and work in my lab now that shows that many of these things extend into the auditory world as well. But there's way more data across all of neuroscience and psychology for the visual system. It is the system we study the most and know the most about. And so that's why you're seeing that reflection. It grows out of our biases. It's a system we know very well, and it's a very, very powerful aspect of our behavior. But for the most part, my intuition would be there are generalizable lessons that will work across all the senses.
So from your work in electrical stimulation, what's going on there? Why is it helping? What's going on?
It seems to be changing the membrane potentials and allowing neurons to fire more readily when stimulated. So there's work now in animal models to try to figure out what the basic physiology of that is. But that's basically what it's doing, just changing resting membrane potentials and thus increasing the plasticity of an area when it's stimulated. At least that's what the idea is now. It's sort of new.
Data points, what kind of voltage and so on?
Say it again.
Can you provide some data points? How much stimulation, how much electrical, is it voltage or wattage you're using?
Like a milliamp. Most studies like 1 to 1.25 milliamps. And whether you use the cathode or the anode as the direction, you could get an excitatory or an inhibitory effect. It's pretty crazy. Sometimes decreasing brain activity is helpful. Like an area could be over-functioning. So a lot of people are looking at that as a way of improving behavior, like in, you know, obsessive compulsive disorder, for example, things like that.
Well, where were you yesterday? Japan?
No, Cartagena.
Oh, Cartagena? So we'll let him go home now. What do you think? Thank you all for coming. Thank you. Right, I knew it was Cartagena.